which he received about the death of his son, the manner in which he reacted. And this stuff is very, very interesting. Of course, it's another thing which you can gloss over very quickly. Okay, you read the story, they sent back the coat, torn into pieces and filled with blood, and he recognized it, and he said that a wild animal has eaten him and so forth, and then he went into mourning. You can read it very quickly and superficially, and I think you'll miss out on a great deal, because I think that, as we pointed out, just about every pasuk of the Torah is filled with tremendously important ideas. So that's what I want to take up today. In Perek Lamed Zayin, that's after the brothers have decided to sell Yosef. That was the intervention of Yehuda. I didn't go into that. We discussed the reason, the motivation for the plan to kill him. Then Reuben changes the plan and decides, convinces them instead of killing him to throw him into the pit. That, of course, is very problematical. I've taken it up in the past. I won't take it up right now. And then there's the intervention of Yehuda, who changed the plan completely. As opposed to throwing him in the pit, let us sell him as a slave. Okay. Then what happens? Let's take the story from that point on. Then, as you know, Reuben returns to the pit. And Reuben's plan all along was to really save him, to save Yosef from the brothers. And strangely enough, even this is fascinating. He didn't tell this to the brothers. He convinced them. He was stalling for time to convince them, instead of killing him, to throw him into the pit. And the pasuk makes it clear that his intention was to come to save him, to come back later and to remove him and bring him back. Of course, he didn't tell this to the brothers. Ironically, however, he wasn't there at the time of the Mechira. And that's the subject for another discussion. We've discussed this in the past. I don't know if I'll be taking it up this year, but you can start, you know, thinking about it. Well, what was he doing? Where was he? Suddenly he returns to the pit and discovers that Yosef is gone, and he tears his garments. Did he tear his garments because he was in mourning for his brother, or did he tear his garments because he was upset with his own situation with his father? Not clear from the pasuk. And then he returns to the brothers and he says, the lad is gone, and I don't know where I'm going. I don't know what to do. I don't know where I'm going to go. Which Rashi interprets to mean, I don't know how I'll escape from the wrath of my father. In other words, Reuven held himself responsible. As the older son, he was responsible. And his problem was, how could he face Yaakov? Okay. Now the plan continues. The brothers have sold him, and they have to deal with Yaakov. And that's the next story. How they deal with Yaakov. So they took the coat of Yosef, and they slaughtered a goat, and they dipped the coat in blood. So here is the alibi, which they had planned all along. And they sent the coat of colors, of many colors, and they brought it to their father, and they said, this is what we found. Hakerna, please identify, is this the coat of your son or not? This pasuk is a bit problematical. Take a look at Lamed Beis. What is problematical about the pasuk? The way it's constructed. What do you mean? Yes. It doesn't make sense. On a plain reading, it doesn't make sense. It says they sent it, which indicates that they were not the ones who brought it. And then it says, and they brought it. Well, if that's the case, they couldn't have been the ones who sent it, because you can't send a gift and bring it simultaneously. I don't think it's possible. Right? Okay? Did you ever notice this before? Ramban discusses it. You appreciate the Mefarshim. By the way, you should read Chumash first without the Mefarshim, and try and spot the problems yourself. You'll appreciate the Mefarshim much more if you're going to them with a sense of what the difficulties are. Sometimes they'll bring up problems that you didn't notice, which is fine too. Two possibilities. Ramban says that they sent it, and basically like what he was saying, and then they brought it, not they personally, but in other words, it was brought to the father under their direction, so it's as though they brought it. That's one of his interpretations. That's his first interpretation. He says, b'tzivuye. In other words, it was brought to their father at their command. Alright? Or else, he says, he suggests another possibility, which is difficult. He says it's also possible to say that they sent it. But where did they send it? They had, one of the brothers had a home in Hebron. They sent it ahead of them. In other words, they sent it ahead of them. And then they gathered together and they, whatever, they finished what they were doing. First they sent a coat ahead of them to be placed in one of their houses. And then, by Aviv, then they came. And that's the interpretation. I guess the difference, the key difference is who exactly brought it to the father or not. To me, that's of significance. Did they themselves personally bring it to their father, or did they have some other people bring it to the father? To me, that's the key issue. The way I always read it, it's a very important point, is that somebody else brought it, because it says by a shalchu. I tend to favor that, because if that is the way they do, you see, the Torah is not a history book. The Torah is not recording specifics and details. If they brought the coat to the father and presented it to him, so that's all I have to know. It's of no interest how they, why, first of all, why would they send it ahead? Why would they send it ahead and pick it up later? What's the significance? Well, let me just take the question. So that's the issue. Why say they sent it? Now, to me, however, if they did not bring it personally, but rather sent it through a messenger, that's significant. Then I can understand why the Torah wants us to know that, because it is telling us something over here about the way they were acting. So I always, just from Vayishalchu, I took it to mean that they sent it. And to me this was a criticism of the brothers, because it always struck me that they were lacking in compassion over here with regard to their father. And as I pointed out, I think it was last week, that the mistake that Yaakov made was in showing his favoritism. He showed his favoritism to Yosef via the coat. The coat is extremely significant over here. It's not by accident that they choose the coat as the most suitable object by which the father should identify the fact that Yosef is gone. But it says that they saw that he loved Yosef more than the brothers, and they hated him. And we said that really, why should they hate Yosef? They really should have directed their anger against the father. And we said that in point of fact, that no question about it, that the anger against Yosef was really a displaced anger. It was an anger against the father. That's always going to be the case. When a father shows favoritism, the students will resent the parent or the teacher, but they'll displace it. And here, it seems to me there's a certain amount of coldness. There's a certain amount of coldness in the way they do it. If you say that they sent it, so they weren't even there, and like here, they're throwing it in his face. Hakerna, identify it. That's very cold. That's lacking in sympathy. But the Ramban does say that it's possible to say that they themselves brought it, which would sort of change it. But I have a problem. Then why did they say Vayishalchu? According to Ramban. Okay, let me ask you a fundamental question that ties in over here. Obviously, the brothers had a problem, and they had to present some type of a scenario. They had to, to find some type of, because they're involved in a cover-up over here. And they chose this method. But let me ask you, it just occurred to me the first time. It never occurred to me before, but as I was learning this area this year, and it's a very basic question, it just wants to show you that you could study this story many, many times, and there are basic questions that you haven't even gotten at. Why do the brothers have to do anything? Why do they have to get, why this whole business with the coat? Why do they have to send anything back to Yaakov? Why don't they just come back from the from their mission with the sheep? They were taking care of the sheep, come back. And they don't have to know. I mean, why get involved? I would say it's always best. They always say it's always best if you can't tell the truth. If you can't tell the truth. Alright? Because that's the easiest thing to remember. And if you have to, for whatever reason, sometimes even according to Halacha, you can't tell the truth, you have to make up a story, so try and keep it simple. Although, whatever you're not telling the truth, you're going to get caught. They can break it down. One second. Because the option was, they don't know from nothing. They just come back. What deal, once you're dealing, you're presenting the garment, there's problems already. First you have a garment, then he'll start asking questions, then you have to give answers. Then you have 10 brothers there. Benjamin wasn't there, so you have 10 brothers. Different brothers can tell a different story. Even if we're on the basis of what you're saying, we found, where'd you find, what position, I mean, there's an investigation. So what do you have to start with problems? You have 10 people here telling the story. Why don't they just decide to come home and say nothing? We don't know from nothing. Now, Yaakov doesn't know nothing, so what's going to happen? After a while, Yaakov is missing. After a while, they're going to send out a search party. No one's going to find him.
That's the way they eliminate doing anything about it. He died.
Hold on a second. But Yosef is in Egypt. Do you think that Yaakov would go to Egypt?
Egypt, yes.
He would go to Egypt?
Okay.
That's what you think.
Abraham went to Egypt.
If that's what you
it's
think.
It's a neighbor country. You would.
It's hard to imagine. So to imagine, but it's possible to imagine.
All right.
In other words, you're saying like this. Okay, maybe you're right. That possibility I always have to keep in mind, you know. I can say this, it can be simple. I just made the question. The issue is discussed by the Ramban, so it is an issue. He doesn't discuss it openly. He switches from the explanation that he's dealing with that issue. Let me just see if I have you what you're saying clearly. In other words, the brothers had to do this because if they had not done this, then he would have launched a worldwide investigation. Given the situation of the time, he would have searched the entire world, and of course, he would have eventually would have found them, and there would have been bad news. That's your explanation. You're saying the question is, was this done for altruistic reasons? One of the girls in the girls' school has suggested that it was out of compassion for the father. Because there's a difference, bear in mind, there's two different stories over here. One story is they don't have a story, so therefore he's missing an action. And a missing an action kind of a situation is possibly that's the worst situation to be in, because you can't put it behind you. You can't go on, because you've lost your son. And all indications are that something terrible has happened. On the other hand, you can't even go past that and mourn because it's missing. Maybe he's still alive. Let me just explain what the Ramban says. Ramban gives a more practical explanation. And he says that they did this, the purpose of sending the coat, see, it may tie in with the issue that Jan raised before, was to distance themselves from the situation. They did it for selfish reasons. It was not done for compassion. But they were protecting themselves, because if they would have kept quiet, he would have been chosher them. He would have suspected them, saying, you killed him. Because he knew of the jealousy. He knew of the jealousy. Now you have to take everything in context. If, on the one hand, I raised the question, if he knew of the dangers and so forth, how would he send Yosef to be killed? The answer is he was aware. You have to know how the mind works. A person you can know, and you do know, about hostilities and so forth, people don't like each other, the quality of the emotion is something which you can know, but it's very difficult sometimes to gauge the quantity of an emotion. So Yaakov was not naive. He realized that there was animosity, but it never dawned on him the extent of it, that the brothers kept hidden from Yaakov. And you can't blame Yaakov for that, because it's very difficult to gauge the quantity of an emotion. You know yourself in your own lives with different relationships that very often you dislike somebody intensely. That's one reason or another you can't manifest it. Either you act as though you're friendly, or you just show a slight dislike, but inwardly you can't stand the person. Now, therefore there was a danger. The brothers acted very brilliantly over here in terms of covering up the crime. They understood the psychology. It was dangerous to leave it an open issue. If they would come back and there's no Yosef, so you happen to be right. I don't go that far as to say that that the fear was that he actually tracked. I think they more or less, the reason why they accepted the plan of Yehuda was because, but it was a plan which did not necessitate their actually killing him. So, as I said, they acted with a reason, but because they consider him to be a tremendous threat to the future of Klal Yisrael, as I explained last week. And they therefore decided that it was morally obligatory to get rid of him. But once they realized that they could remove him from doing any danger without actually killing him, they accepted that plan. That was the plan of Yehuda. The plan was, practically speaking, if he sold as a slave to Egypt, there's no way, in terms of the ordinary laws of nature, that he's going to work his way out of that situation and become a threat to us. But at the same time, so why do we have to kill him? We have no right to kill him unless it's absolutely necessary. So I have another alternative. You have a right to maintain that idea if you want. I wouldn't say that they were thinking that Yaakov would launch a worldwide search. The chances of his being found were very, very remote. But the suspicion would fall on them. And the issue would not be resolved. The issue would not be resolved in Yaakov's mind. As long as it was not resolved in Yaakov's mind, there'd always be to a certain extent, you're right, he might investigate. But more than that, the suspicion would focus on them, and then it's a pressure. And one of them could crack. So therefore, they had their concern was to resolve the issue, to put the matter at rest, to set it up in such a way that it's brilliant. They didn't come back with a report that an animal had torn them apart and all of that. They set it up in such a way so that they knew how Yaakov fit, that Yaakov would come to that conclusion. And that's the best way, in other words, is when you set it up in such a way that the other person, through his own logical process, he arrives at that conclusion. That's why they set it up in that way. And it makes much more sense. They weren't distancing themselves from the situation. This is what we found. Zos matzano. Now, that's why I think there's a problem with what Jan is saying, because they said Zos matzano. Where did we find it? Where did we find it? So, apparently, we found it out in the woods somewhere, where we were with the sheep, but they didn't say exactly where. That's the implication. We found it. And then they're saying Hakerna, Haksonas bin Chihiolo. And, you know, we can't identify it, but in other words, we're not sure. Since we had nothing to do with this, it wasn't part of our plan. We found this, it looks like it, but we're not the ones that can identify it. Only you can identify it, because you gave it to him. Is this his code or not? They acted in a way which would enable Yaakov to come to a certain conclusion. That's why Rama Gimel Vayakira, and he recognized it, and he said, "Ksonas bini, it's the garment of my son. Chayarah achalasu, an evil animal has eaten him. Torof Yosef. Yosef has been torn to bits." That's exactly what they wanted. They wanted him to arrive at a certain conclusion with regard to this. And that would be much better. Then they figured they could go on from there. Now, let's take it up from there. What happens next? What happens next, I think, is very fascinating. Vayikra Yaakov Simlosov. Yaakov tore his garments, and he placed his sackcloth around his loins. And he mourned for his son many days. Yamim Rab. Alright. Then it says that all of his sons and daughters, and the daughters over here are either his daughters-in-law, according to some, or his granddaughters, either way, different shatim, to comfort him, nicham aveilim. And he refused to be comforted, and he said, "For I will go down to my grave in mourning." And his father cried for him. And then it says that the Midyanim sold him to the triumph of Potiphar, the minister of Pharaoh. The chief of the cooks, or the executioners, whatever you want to say. Over here. It's a matter of halacha, not according to halacha. And Rambam points out that with regard to mourning, there's two extremes: that the person that doesn't mourn for relatives or those who he's supposed to mourn over is considered to be an Achzar. That's an indication of a certain
cruelty. Ach zar, the word is broken. That really, ach zar means cruel. Only ach means only, zar is a stranger. It means that he can't identify with somebody else's plight. On the other side, therefore, there's an obligation of mourning. On the other hand, there's a limitation on mourning. And he says that a person who mourns too much, excessively, that's in violation of the Torah. That's how you can't accept reality. A person has to accept that this is the reality, that physical life is finite, it's temporary, and the ultimate good is Olam Haba. And we have relationships. A person has to have a certain attitude that we have relationships, we have attachments, and they're important, and therefore there's mourning. But then he has to realize that he has to be able to detach himself from relationships and to redirect himself towards others, and ultimately, of course, to his relationship to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So a person that's stuck in mourning is really in violation of the Torah. It's not God's will, that's part of reality. If people were to not have the ability to get over, that's why Rashi points out that normally for a meis de shikha, after 12 months you forget. It means to say you get over it. You get over it, then you move on. If that were not the case, then we couldn't survive. Mankind could not go on, because everyone experiences losses. So that's problematical, and especially I would imagine that this is so for an ordinary person, but for someone who's on the level of Yaakov Avinu, on the highest possible level, one would expect that he would be able to survive and get over it. But what's more difficult than that is that the pasuk is not even saying that he couldn't get over it. Can you tell me that for some reason he refused? By your mindless nachim, he refused. He wouldn't accept their nechama. Now, I know the famous Rashi. I'm sure you're all familiar with the Rashi. Rashi says something which is very strange. And again, I defy anyone to take it literally. That's my point. I've been on a campaign against literal understandings of Midrashim. Rashi says like this, mindless nachem, he quotes the Bereshis Rabbah. A person, he says, of course, a person does not accept the consolation for the living, v'savar shemes, but he thinks he's dead. Shalames nigzurag zera, sheishtakach min halei. Because it's only with regard to a real mace that God has decreed that it should be forgotten. V'lo halachai, not halachai. Okay? Now, what is difficult about this, if you take it literally? And I contend that it's a distortion of Torah to take this literally. I'll show you why. Yes? There was a misunderstanding. The children get up to comfort him. They assume that he would be capable of receiving consolation. That's what they assume. He taught them a new idea. When the prophet says, it doesn't just stop and says that he refused to be comforted. It says he said something. What he said, I will go down to my grave mourning. He was teaching them a concept over here. Because why does the Torah have to record this? And how did he know that he would go down to his grave mourning? He should have simply said that right now it's not the time yet. It's not time. I need more time. But he did more than that. He made a definitive statement. But I want to go back to the Rashi. What is difficult about the Rashi? Rashi says that the problem was because, see, really, he was alive. And God allows you to be able to write only when the person is actually dead. But here he was alive and he thought. What's difficult about that? Ah. See, if you take it literally, it sounds extremely mystical. What do you mean? You mean to say that this is not a natural process? It's a decree? I mean, God decrees that you should forget, and God only decrees when the person is real. It doesn't make any sense. Because, Manashach, if you're going to tell me that when a person is really alive, so therefore there's no mourning, so why did he mourn? Then he shouldn't have mourned. You have to, that part, insofar as the mourning is concerned, that exists even in a case where the person is alive but you think he's dead. However, the flip side of mourning, that is to say when a person actually gets over it, that doesn't exist in that case. It does not make any sense. I'll tell you why. Because it's a psychological phenomenon. It makes no difference, really, if the person is alive or dead, as long as the person is convinced. If the person is convinced that mourning sets in because you believe, mourning doesn't set in because the person is actually dead. Mourning sets in because you believe. And the truth of the matter is, you can make an experiment or whatever. There's no doubt whatsoever that if a person were convinced that a relative of theirs had died, and a ship exploded, and they saw the explosion, right? And there's no room for any doubt. Then they would go into mourning. And they would mourn. And then they'd get over, whatever. They'd get over it after 12 months, a year, whatever the case may be. And it just so turned out because of some freak accident that the person was saved would have absolutely no difference in terms of the mourner. Because mourning is a psychological phenomenon based upon what you believe. And therefore, it's not a mystical thing. However, as you're saying, what Rashi could be meaning, I've heard this explanation, what Rashi could be alluding to is that shikha is possible only in a situation where there's absolutely no doubt in the person's mind. And Yaakov over here was not entirely convinced. Of course, he said, Chayara Chalasu, Taraf Yosef, he said that because he had to come to a certain conclusion, and the most logical conclusion was that this is what happened, and that's what he has to live with. He has to accept that. But that doesn't mean to say that at a certain level of his consciousness there weren't doubts, and as long as there are doubts, you can't get over it. It's a psychological explanation of how the mechanism works. Mourning is possible only when there's an absolute conviction, so then I must accept it. That's the missing in action phenomenon, that a person will not mourn properly because even though most of the evidence indicates death, but as long as there's a possibility of hope, I keep going back. Maybe it's still alive. If it's maybe it's still alive, then I can't mourn. Mourning only begins when there's absolutely no room for hope. That's what Rashi said. However, I am going to go with a different shot on this. That's not the plain shot. That's a Medrash Rabbah. What I want to go to is the Sforno. I want to take up the Sforno. The Sforno says like this. And he refused to be comforted. He says he wouldn't listen to words of consolation in order to remove the daiga from his heart. He refused. It was a shita. That's a very interesting thing. You don't get this from reading the pasuk. According to the Sforno, he absolutely refused because he didn't want to lose that feeling of sadness. And he said, I will go down to my grave mourning. What does that mean? I asked the question, how does he know that? Maybe next year he'll feel better. Things change. So, kibel al avelos, l'chol yamav. This is the fascinating thing. He was makabel. He accepted upon himself. It was a deliberate choice. I accept upon myself to be permanently in avelos all my days. Why? Why? He feels responsible because the takala came about through his hands. It's an amazing thing. He says, because the takala came about through his hands, because he sent Yosef to the brothers. Because he sent Yosef to the brothers. This itself is not so simple, though. Wait one second. But did he think the brothers did it? But no, he didn't. He didn't accuse the brothers. This is difficult, because it's true he sent him to the brothers, but consciously he wasn't accusing. Unconsciously you may argue that he had some suspicions, but on the conscious level he didn't hold him responsible. And this Sforno is learning on the conscious level. That on the conscious level he took upon himself a permanent avelus because this catastrophe came about through his hands. Alright? Now by Yevch Oso Aviv, that also stands out. How does that fit in? Well, who's he talking about? Who cried over who? Vayech oso aviv. Who cried over who? Is that Yaakov crying over Yosef? No. It's very hard to learn it that way. These three words just stand out. Totally disconnected. Now, many Mepharshim say it's a reference to the father of Yaakov, to Yitzchak. Yitzchak cries for him. All of a sudden, out of nowhere, Yitzchak comes and says, but Yitzchak is not part of the story at all. Yitzchak is not part of the story at all. We have not. No, Yitzchak was alive. But that's the Derech HaTorah.
But then it's good.
Yes, it's good.
If it's a line, doesn't he feel dead?
So Rashi has no problem with this. Rashi says that Vayif also of him. Yitzchak cried for who? For Yaakov. Because of the sadness of Yaakov. But he didn't cry because of the missing his grandson Yosef. Because he knew that Yosef was what? No, because he had Nevuah. He had Nevuah and he knew. That's not plain shot. That's what Rashi says. Yitzchak Bocha Hayyitzaros of Yaakov. Yitzchak cried because of the pain of Yaakov. But he wasn't in mourning. Because he knew the truth. That's what Rashi says. So of course your question is, why wouldn't he tell his son, right? Why wouldn't he tell the truth? For now, explains it also as a reference to Yitzchak. Vayef also of him. His father cried to him. Yitzchak cried because Yaakov accepted Avelus the Chol Yomah. Not because he doesn't mention that he knew. So that gets you out of that problem. Not that Yitzchak was not concerned about Yosef. That's not the issue. But he was very upset about the reaction of Yaakov because he accepted Avelus the Chol Yomah uvechein lo tishra lo shmina. And because of that, the Shmina means that God's presence, meaning to say Ruach HaKodesh. That we know that Yaakov was on the level of Nevuah. And if not Nevuah, then on Ruach HaKodesh, which means on the highest possible level of human perfection, and that when a person's in a state of sadness and mourning, so he's not functioning at his best in terms of his relationship with God, in terms of his understanding, his knowledge. That's what it means by Shechina. It's a loss. It's a loss in terms of his spiritual life. So Yaakov, by doing this, was undertaking upon himself a state which would be detrimental in terms of being in the highest level of perfection, and that's why Yitzchak cried. Now, I want to base myself on the explanation of the Sforno, and to me this is tremendously problematical for all the reasons we've mentioned. First of all, why wouldn't the natural course of Avelis go into effect over here? Why wouldn't the Yaakov be able to mourn? He says he mourned many days. See, first, interestingly, the children didn't intervene right away in the first expression of mourning, on Lama Dalet. They let him mourn, because you have to know when to console. You're not supposed to try and console a person when Meso Mutlafanov, when the deceased is right in front of him. He can't even listen. In fact, to offer consolation at that point would be cruel. Because when a person has just suffered a loss, so how can you, by the attempt to console, is already detracting from the loss. You're saying that this is something, the person's state of mind is that there is no consolation. So you have to wait. Yes, I'm sorry? Problems are. My problems are that the way the Sforno explained it, none of this makes sense. Because why would he refuse to accept Tanchumen in order to, he wanted to retain the sadness in his heart, the daiga, the worry. He didn't want to remove the worry in his heart. That's the first thing. When that's connected the philosophy of Yonadus, that a person is not supposed to remain in a permanent state, and especially if you can get out of it somehow. Then he says that he says, I'll go down to my grave mourning. He was makabel, he accepted Averus for all of his days. Why? Because he was responsible somehow. But if that's the case, so why should, let's say it's true, let's say he was responsible somehow, so then you do tshuva. It doesn't mean he has to go up to Jesus because he made a mistake. So let's say he made a mistake. Okay? So, because the person makes a mistake, he has to go into mourning for the rest of his life? I don't think that's a philosophy that we accept. We all make mistakes. And we all make mistakes with regard to our children. And we all do the wrong thing. And sometimes bad things happen as a result. So what are you supposed to do? See, you're supposed to do tshuva, like anything else. And you're supposed to learn. And of course you should feel sad for a certain amount of time, but then you have to get out of it, learn the lesson, and move on. That's the way to go, because we're always making mistakes and we're always facing consequences, and we'll always be in a state of mourning. Then we'll never get out of this. And then God doesn't want us to be in a permanent state of mourning, because ultimately You're supposed to take all your mistakes and learn from them and be happy. That's the objective. Okay? If you can't serve God b'simcha, then you're lacking in something. So you can't be in a state of mourning all the time. See, it's a big avera to be unhappy. People don't realize it. Serious avera to be unhappy. I'll explain that more fully some other time. I mean that seriously. So all of this goes contrary. All this goes contrary to basic established principles of Yahadus, it would seem to me. That he told them that he's going to go down. It's like a refusal. I refuse to be comforted. And that's simply inappropriate. A person has to be makabel tanchumim. The whole institution of Nicham Avelim presupposes that the mourner is going to be makabel, is going to accept tanchumim. For a mourner today, not to accept tanchumim would be wrong. So that's my question. I would like to understand. And what was he was telling? He was teaching them something. See, the children didn't know this. The children did not anticipate this. They assumed that the time had come. They waited a while. They knew that it was a big blow. They waited a while. And once the time had gone by, where he had calmed down from the initial onslaught of mourning, and he was seemed to be calming down, coming back to himself, then they offered tanchumen, and then he just said, no, impossible. So that's my problem, and that's what I'm going to try and resolve. In my opinion, in order to understand this, we have to understand the whole relationship, the love of, as Marlene points out. I'd like to elucidate it more specifically. I think that this avelus can only be understood if we understand the nature of the relationship between Yaakov and Yosef, which we've never fully elucidated. All we said was that he was the favorite. And all the pasuk points out is that he was ben zakunim. And let's turn back to that now. That's at the beginning of Vayeshev. And the pasuk says, "V'Yisrael Av is Yosef Mikol Banav," and Israel. Interesting, the word V'Yisrael instead of Yaakov. Because at the beginning, just two psukim before, it says Vayeshev Yaakov. We're talking about Elo told us Yaakov. We're talking about Yaakov, and suddenly there's a switch. V'Yisrael Av is Yosef Mikol Banav. V'Yisrael loved Yosef more than all of his sons. He ben zakunim hulo, for he was the ben zakunim, the child of old age. Now I would like to understand, what does that mean? I know when you read it you have a certain idea, it evokes a certain emotion, the ben zakunim, but I defy you to understand, to explain it. What exactly does that mean? Now is that the way most people take it, that a child that's born in old age, when you don't, I guess I'm not quite sure what the thing is myself, even though I'm told that I have a ben zakunim. For the life of me, can't understand it. That this is the way it seems to me, that you're older and at a point where you did not expect to have children anymore. So therefore it's very special to you, because you didn't expect to have children, now you had a child, and therefore this child you love more than the others. That's the way it's explained. I don't understand that. And if you're going to say that's the case, you're going to have a big problem. Because if that's the case, Yosef is not the ben zakunim. Who's the ben zakunim? Binyamin. Binyamin is the real ben zakunim, because he was the last child, so Yaakov was even older. If you mean to say it's the child of old age when you're the oldest, then it should be Binyamin. And as the Ramban points out, all of his children were Bnei Zakunim. He wasn't a youngster. He started married life when he was about 84 years old. So I guess every kid's a Ben, right? So you mean it makes, they're all roughly, and they're not that many years apart. According to the Ramban, then Yosef is not that many years apart from the others, a few years. But the strongest question is, if you're going to say, well, he was of, and if you're going to say he was, I didn't mention, so because he's the child of from Rachel, his favorite wife, but that's not what the pasuk says, and also then again Binyamin. So anywhere you go, you can have problems understanding the concept of ben zakunim. You can have a problem understanding it. You can have another problem, excuse me. Because it's difficult also, we're dealing with Yaakov Avinu, and of course he has emotions, but we want to understand what triggers off his emotion of love. Is it something so mundane and ordinary, this thing of Ben Zakunim? If we're dealing with a man like Yaakov, there must be something unique that would... That, right, right. Okay, so Rashi brings down a few pshatim. Ben Zakunim, Shenolad lo le'es ziknuso. He was born to him at the time of his ziknus, old age. Okay. But we still have problems with that. So was Binyamin. Uncle is Tirgen Bachakin Hulei. That the word Zaken is a reference to wisdom, right? Zaken is Misha Kana Chachma. So this I can understand already. That it wasn't simply a factor of age, but there's a reference here. That's not the plain shot. Of course, Uncle doesn't mean it's the plain shot, but it's a reference to the fact that he was the Baruch HaKim, the one who had the wisdom. So I can understand that would attract someone like Yaakov, because that's the quality that he prized the most. But of course, all of his other sons were Baruch HaKim. I mean, they weren't small people. These were great men. They were all great men, right? Reuven, Yehuda, they're geniuses. They're all on the highest possible level. So what's so special about Yosef? Even if you want to say he was a little bit smarter, but the other children were all brilliant. So that's a... Then there's the third one, which Ronit mentions, and that he looked like him. Which is the hardest one to understand. Ziv Ukinon Shalom, his facial appearance. Okay. You mean 1 out of 12, this is the only one that looked like him? Mm-hmm. I don't know. I would say like this. Well, the Ramban has an explanation. I'm not going to make... You can look at the Ramban's explanation. I would say that in a case like this, it's not a question of either or. I think there's a certain amount of truth in all of them. And they blend together. Bear in mind also that you can't ignore the way the Torah expressed it, that there is a concept of Ben Zakunim. Because if the essential factor was wisdom, then the Torah could have said ki ben chacham hulo. Why did it have to use a roundabout expression of ben zakunim? I would say that there's an element of truth in all of these three, and I will say also that whenever you have a very powerful attraction, an emotion of love, it's what psychologists call multi-determined. It doesn't stem from one source. You have different levels of feeling. Some people you like. Some people you like a lot. Then you have love. Then you have crazy, mad love, passion. It means to say the greater the love, it's more multi-determined, which means it hits you on different levels. Some people you like because it's just the way they look. Now some then you like, well, they look, and also the personality. Well, they look, personality, and then they're intelligent. You can have kindness. So the more areas in which it's making an impact upon you, the greater the love. So the one you love the most, obviously, is going to hit you on many levels. Now, I'd like to explain. I have my own explanation of Ben Zakunim. And I want to present it to you. And on the basis of this, I think I'll try to explain why it would produce, it would flow naturally, cause and effect, that Avelis that we just discussed, that type of mourning. Zakunim. There are two factors involved, though, in my opinion. Two things came together at this point to cause this tremendous bond. One is the state of Yaakov. You have to understand, there are different phases in a person's life. And if a person lives properly, he tries to make the most, he maximizes in every phase. And there's the phase in a person's life when he's building. He's fulfilling his mission, whatever that may be. And certainly Yaakov had a tremendously important mission, which entailed two things. He was a transition point. He was responsible for establishing Klal Yisrael, because the period of the Avos was coming to, he was the last of the Avos. And now he needed the transition into the entity that would form a people. And the units were the Shvatim, were the tribes. His basic mission was to see to it that Kali Yisrael would move forward to the next level of development. Of course, this entailed two things. First of all, his own personal perfection, mainly through acquisition of the Torah knowledge, the most advanced level of Torah knowledge, metaphysics and so forth, which had been bequeathed by Avram and Yitzchak now to him. He had to become the intellectual leader of Klal Yisrael. And then he had a new mission, which neither of the others had had, and that is to establish the Shvat, to raise the children, to establish them. And he had to go through all the tremendous battles that he was involved in, with Lavan and Esav and so on and so forth, in order to establish the foundation for the existence of the Tzibur, because after him there'd be a Tzibur. So I would say at this point in time, the Vayeshev Yaakov, Bikesh Yaakov Leshe B'Shalva, Rashi says, he reached the point where he'd done his thing already. He, in my opinion, okay, it wasn't over yet, but he'd done everything he had to do. He fulfilled his mission. He'd gone through all the wars, he'd gone through all the battles, he'd had the children. He had Yosef, he had Binyamin. So now he's in a period of Zikness. Now I would say that there was only one thing left for him to do. I'm going to give you a rough analogy over here, which is very, don't take it literally, because it would trivialize the whole thing, and that's not what I mean, but I'm just using it to try and evoke a certain picture. It's not the case of Yaakov, but just to make it a little bit easier to understand what I'm talking about, you read about sometimes people that have had a career, then they get old, and when they get old, they feel kind of like useless. They don't know what to do. They've done their... like that, let's say a person was an athlete or involved in some sport, some art, whatever the case may be, an artist but can't paint anymore. They discover a student, and now they have a whole new mission in life. The student sort of is an extension of themselves, and the whole thing is to give this over. Well, they've discovered something very, very important. They're past their age of creativity, but now the idea of giving it over to somebody else, and that becomes your whole life. Either it's not just identification, but they have a whole purpose now. They're perpetuating their idea to be somebody else. Now, it's a rough analogy. Now suddenly this person comes to life. He's living again by giving over all of his knowledge to somebody else. It's wrong, because I don't imagine that that's the state that Yaakov was in. That Yaakov was bored and had nothing to do, because he was involved in his knowledge. Even a person, see, that's the one of the benefits of being involved in Torah. That even in old age, he'll always have a source of tremendous satisfaction and contentment, because he can always be involved in the study of Torah as long as he has his mind. So he doesn't have to have his physical powers. He doesn't have to have the ability to go around, but he could open up a Gemara. He could have a student. He can give a shiur, get involved in learning. That's why it's the greatest possible good of all. But I would say that there was one thing left which had not been achieved in terms of his purpose. And it came at just the right time in his life. His objective was to be mamed the Shiftei Kah, to establish the Shiftei Kah. And he had the 12 sons. But there was one thing that wasn't there. He had to have one son. In every generation there was the spiritual leader, the one who had achieved the most advanced level of metaphysical knowledge which had been bequeathed. And that's what Yosef was. Until Yosef came along, it wasn't complete. Yosef was that individual. It says that he gave over to him, Rashi says, Bacha Kimule, Koma Shalomag Mishem V'Eva Masalo, everything which he had learned from Shem and Avery gave to him. It means to say that even though the other sons were on a very high level, but this is a special level. Not everybody can enter into the paradise, so to speak. That is to say, into the most advanced levels of metaphysical knowledge. And for Klal Yisrael, there has to be someone who would be the leader. And that leader had to be someone who had this advanced knowledge. And that's why he saw it in Yosef. What's that? See, Yosef was special. That's what Rashi means, Baruch HaKim. That he had this quality which none of the other sons had. He reached a certain level which was above and beyond. And Yaakov now found somebody who
on an objective level would be vital for the mission of Christ himself, and on a personal level, at a time in his life when he had completed all of his studies and he had reached the most advanced levels, he now had someone he could share it with. For a chacham, that's the most, someone who's involved in learning loves to give it over to somebody else. But let's say you have an advanced idea, very, very advanced, very, very abstract, and there's nobody really you can share it with. You can't teach it to anyone. There's a tremendous enjoyment. There's a tremendous enjoyment, like the Chazal say, I learned a lot from my teachers. I learned even more from my chaverim, from my colleagues. But mitalmidai yosef mitzvah. That the experience of a rebbe with a talmud is the greatest possible thing, because they broaden his knowledge and they expand his knowledge. And that joy that a rebbe has with a talmud, not just, of course, on any level, but on the more advanced the level, the more metaphysical the level, that is the greatest joy, and that is the greatest bond that two people can have. The real bonding between two people has to be, the highest level is that which stems from the highest part of man. You bond together for many reasons. So, if it's because of an emotion, it's just an emotional bonding, it's one level. If it's instinctual, it's another level. But the greatest relationship, the closest relationship, is that which stems from the highest part of man. And that is his Tzelem Elokim. And the most advanced metaphysical represents the highest degree that the Tzelem Elokim can reach. And that's that was all Ben Zakunim. It's all under Ben Zakunim, because it came at, had this happened 10 years before, it wouldn't have had the same effect, because he was still involved. Insofar as he's involved in building and working out the ideas, of course it's an enjoyment of teaching, but the primary thrust of his energy is involved in the creativity. It comes at a time when he's more or less finished the creativity, the theories, the ideas, it was all complete. And now there was a tremendous desire to give this over to somebody else, personally for Yaakov, Ben Zakunim, and for the sake of Klal Yisrael. And that's why the Yisrael, if you're going to tell me, if you're going to tell me that this is the what everybody thinks because of old age, so then he's the child that was born to him at old age, it should have happened when he was born, when he was an infant. It wasn't. This didn't occur when he was the Yisrael. When he became Yisrael. And Yisrael means what? He became Yisrael after he completed his mission. So Yisrael represents the point at which Yaakov had reached his personal level of perfection, and it also indicates to us that Yosef wasn't a baby at this point, because Yosef was already a child. He was a few years old. In other words, at that point in time, he could detect that he had this. How would he know as an infant that he's the Baruch Hakim? If you're going to tell me that this bond occurred when he was an infant, then how are you going to tell me that as an infant he already knew that he's Baruch Hakim and he can give over all these chachmas from Shem and Eiv? It doesn't make any sense whatsoever. But it means to say that two things came into being simultaneously. Yaakov had now reached a point in time in his life when the most important thing to him was to give over the special chachmos, which he couldn't give to anybody else. Not every chacham is roy for it. And it was the most vital. He was happy because he knew that the future of Klal Yisrael demanded that there be such a leader. And, of course, Rashi points out, we're still dealing on a human level. There formed a tremendous identification, and it was on the emotional, as I said, it's multi-determined. The fact that he was like him, maybe he looked more like him than the others, there was a tremendous bond between them, identification, but the ultimate identification was not because he looked like him, it was because he was able to share the chachma, the special chachma that he had from Shem Yeva. And that, all of that, that's why it's a very special kind of thing. This is befitting a man like Yaakov, this type of a love. This type of a love is different. It means to say, it's not an ordinary love. It means to say, v'nafsho k'su v'nafsho. His whole identification as an individual, his whole life is tied up with the other person. He becomes a part of his very life. That's his whole life now. Sharing the chachma together with him. That becomes his whole life. That is, you see that type of a relationship defines Tanakh. David Yonatan. Right? The nefesh, David Shur b'nefesh Yonatan. Or the other one. The nefesh Yonatan Shur b'nefesh Yonatan. I don't remember how. V'nafsho k'su v'nafsho. And you will see that's what Yaakov taught the son. That's why, in my opinion, there's no avail for that kind of a loss.
There's no avilus. How can you have another? How can you get over such a thing? It means to say that he's not going to be fully alive anymore. He realized that at this point in time, that was his life. The whole essence of his life was to give over the chachmos. It was a tremendous loss for him and a tremendous loss for Klal Yisrael. And that's what he's telling them. But in mind, I can't accept tanchumen for this. If I were to accept consolation for this, I would be downgrading the whole thing. You can only accept tanchumen when you say it's okay, it's a loss, it was something very meaningful, but it's not the essence of my life. I can go on. To accept tanchumen would be to be denigrating what it was. And it's the statement of a reality. He refused. He would not allow himself to get involved in something else. And then there was the element of, according to the Sforno, that he blamed himself. He realized that it was a mistake. That he had made a mistake. That he had miscalculated. That he had not taken the matter seriously enough. He had not been serious enough. He had not been careful enough with such a treasure. It doesn't mean, if the takala came back through my hands, that means I made a mistake. Of course the mistake was that he showed favoritism. He may not have been aware, but he sent him into a situation of danger. In doing that, he realized that he had made a mistake, and how can he make a mistake about something which was so vital? And that's why he took it upon himself always to be in a state. Okay. Always to be in a state of avos. Now, this is something that the other children never understood. They never understood the real roots of why he favored the Yosef. Of course, to do so would have been very, very difficult to accept. It would have been a total recognition of the superiority of Yosef. And therefore they attributed it to defects of Yosef, and because Yosef curry favor or whatever it was, and so on and so forth. But the reality, the underlying reality, that he was very special, that he was unique, and anyone that would understand the situation would have to objectively conclude that this is where the love should be, and would not be jealous about it. The brothers weren't prepared for that. They did, as a result of the tshuva, you will see, and this is what Yaakov, that's why they got to confirm, to condone. It's subject to consolation. He said, no, you don't understand. It's not subject to consolation. It's not subject to consolation. You never understood this in the first place. Anyway, I'm going to go down to the grave morning. And finally, the brothers do understand it, because you see, take a look at the Vayigash. In the final plea, when Yehuda speaks up for Binyamin, and Binyamin is the substitute to Yosef, and he said, the whole speech over here, the whole speech, if you take a look at that, you guys will see, we can't go through it now, the whole speech over here is an indication of his recognition of what this relationship was. That's the recognition. Take a look. He'll tell you about the suffering. Well, the Kachnam Gam is there. That's in Pasuk Chavtet. If you take this one, that's after he gives the whole explanation of what my father went through. And now, if I should come back to your servant, my father, and the youth is not with us, that's it, you're just destroying someone. And he finally recognized what Yaakov had been trying to tell him, that this is different. That's why he says, please take me. Take me, he'll get over me. You see the tshuva for the chait? The chait was, why should you like him more than me? The tshuva was, no, take me, me can get over. My father does not feel about me the way he feels about him. And that was their chait. They couldn't accept it to begin with. That the father has a right. It was right for him to have a favorite. Because given all the factors involved, he should be a favorite. He does have the qualities. Of course, Yaakov made a mistake and demonstrated it, but that's because the brothers, that does not exonerate the brothers. They should have been able to overcome the jealousy. And that's why what Yaakov was saying is that this avail is a natural phenomenon. It didn't help. It's a substitute. A substitute can help me get over the pain. I could literally have to live. It's true. He tried to find a substitute, but It didn't detract from the fact that he was an Averach. I'll prove to you that the substitute of Binyam, that he didn't say this, you might say, well, he said this before he realized Binyam would be a substitute, then he found Binyam. Didn't help, I'll tell you why. This is the final point I want to make, which I think proves it conclusively. The reaction of Yaakov when they come back from the Mitzrayim, they tell him the news, oh, Joseph, why? If you Moshe before the Mitzrayim. I think that proves it conclusively. And then, hey, when the brothers come back, after Yosef has told them to bring, he sent the wagons and so forth to bring my father. So Pasuk Chafei, in Menei Chafei, Vayalim in the Mitzrayim, they went up from Egypt and they came to Canaan, to Yaakov their father. And they told him, saying, oh, Yosef, hi. Yosef is still alive. Moshe and he's the ruler of all of Egypt. By Yafad Libo, his heart went out to Elohim, and first he didn't even believe him. By Edad Reilah, they told him by Yosef, Asher Giber Aleihem. Then they told him all the words of Yosef that he had spoken to them. By Yaras HaGolos, and he saw the wagon that Yosef sent to carry him. Now what the Rashi says, the reference over here is the HaGolos Edra Rufa. In other words, what was Yosef sent proof. He knew that Yaakov would be, but it was more than just proof. He was saying that the relationship still exists. I'm still the same Yosef, and I'm still involved in the same Torah that you put me. And then, but the chi ruach Yaakov avim. Then he came back to life. The word it's still playing means to say that he wasn't alive. He was not fully alive. As long as Joseph was there, he was not fully alive. And then, not just that he's physically alive, but that he's still intellectually and spiritually involved in the same ideas that my life is in. Now he's back to life again. And Rashi says, Shor Salav Shlina. In Natachi, take a look at Rashi. Natachi Ruach Yaakov, Shor Salav Shlina. Now the Shlina returns him. Shepir Shemimena. So even with the substitute, Binyamin was an emotional substitute up to a point, helped him alleviate the pain. But it wasn't the same thing. No, I'm saying it was not. According to my interpretation, it was not. It was a reality. It was a reality. It was a different type of thing. In other words, the Rambam, let's say, good point that you're making. The question from the Rambam is now resolved, because the Rambam says that we're not allowed to mourn excessively. That is when it's essentially an emotional attachment. But there is a certain type of a mourning that's never to be forgotten, and that's why every time you go to a wedding, they break a glass and they put ashes on the head of the chatan. That's the meshkechech Yerushalayim tishkachimim. That's the avails over there. That would be usher for us at any time, at any point in time. That's why there's many takanos that Chazal made for the idolos. And some say it's even prohibited to listen to music. Rav Moshe always says you're not supposed to listen to music. They say now it's only when there's Bashirah Tishdayayin, and only when there's wine and certain kinds of parties. It's not so simple. This whole day, I'm not getting involved in the Halach Yish right now, but even ordinary parties that are not for Dvar Mitzvah are questionable. Like people get together just for an ordinary birthday party and there's wine and music, it's really a question of whether that's permitted because of the mourning for the Beis HaMikdash. So that should permeate our lives. And that type of mourning, we're not permitted to forget. What about the Rambam say you shouldn't mourn excessively? Because the Rambam is talking about mourning over something which is an attachment to something, a physical attachment, an emotional attachment to something which is in this world. And that you should, your mind should always be focused on the ultimate good. And therefore that's something that is okay, you partake of it, but then you should be prepared to withdraw and to redirect your energy. But when you're talking about a mourning which is prompted by your attachment to the ultimate good, the mourning for the Beis HaMikdash, that's a chas v'shalom, you're not allowed to forget such a thing. And I would say that's the kind of mourning, that's what he was mechadish, that's when he first began to teach him. You never understood this whole emotion to begin with. You never understood this relationship. And ki eved el v'ni yave el she'olah. And by Yitzchak, all that fits in. Because Yitzchak realized what a tremendous loss it was. That this is Yaakov Avinu would not be on the same level. And as a result of it, if Yaakov tells it, doesn't matter. There's nothing you can do about it. Even if he has to give up the Shechina, there's nothing you can do about it. So that's how I wanted to basically explain this phenomenon. It was a personal factor, in the relationship that it was excessive. The amount of emotional attachment was excessive and caused him to make a mistake. And insofar as that is concerned, that was an impediment. And that's why the whole objective of the Ashkafa was to remove that element and to raise him to a higher level in terms of his personal perfection. That's why he has to be separated from the other and then separated from the other. But I was trying to explain that the essence of this Ahava, which brought about the subsequent Avelos, was rooted in the fact that he had the special qualities that Nafsha true Menafsha, which meant that he was the only one with whom he could share his most advanced metaphysical ideas, and it came at a point in his life when that was the most important thing to do, both for himself personally and for the future of Kol Yisrael.